From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with actress Audrey Hepburn. In the 1950s and 60s, Hepburn was one of the movie's biggest stars. She's now a special ambassador for UNICEF and just returned from a trip to Ethiopia. Also today, I speak with film director Alan Rudolph. His new movie, The Moderns, stars Keith Carradine and Genevieve Bugeaud, who also starred in Rudolph's films Choose Me and Trouble in Mind. Pianist and singer Mac Rebennack is back with another taste of New Orleans music. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone examines Home, ABC's cross between Good Morning America and Hints from Heloise. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Audrey Hepburn is an actress of elegance and grace. Hepburn became one of the leading stars of the 1950s and 60s through her roles in such films as Roman Holiday, Funny Face, The Nun Story, Breakfast at Tiffany's, Charade, My Fair Lady, and Wait Until Dark. She hasn't made a film since 1980 when she appeared in Peter Bogdanovich's They All Laughed. Last month, the British-born actress accepted a position outside the film world. She's serving as a special ambassador of UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund. Her first assignment was a trip last month to Ethiopia. She took a 3-day tour of the UNICEF relief and development projects in the drought-stricken areas of Ethiopia. I just spoke with her from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles about her work with UNICEF and about her film career. She told me first what she observed in her trip to Ethiopia.
The situation is potentially much worse than in 85. There's been even less rain, and the rains that were supposed to fall now in April have failed again. And therefore the drought is worse and the famine could get very, very serious. This time we had an early warning, so aid started earlier, therefore we've not had the terrible tragedies like the last time of people dying by the hundreds before aid ever reached them. Nevertheless, the people are very undernourished, and especially the children. The children are getting some powdered milk and grain and so forth, but they're not getting anywhere near enough supplementary foods like proteins and vitamins, and many of them have eye diseases and skin diseases through lack of vitamins and are going blind.
Since you returned from Ethiopia, there's been a government order expelling all foreign relief workers and closing down UN relief efforts. Now, how is that affecting the programs that you're working on?
Well, they have indeed evacuated all expatriates, if you like, from the area for their safety, because the war has accelerated, as you just said, in the last few days, and the situation is becoming very serious. All international agencies have been evacuated except UNICEF. UNICEF is still there, and the food is still being distributed by the Ethiopian Red Cross and the Ethiopian Church. And all these activities are being monitored by UNICEF.
Do you know why an exception was made for UNICEF when all the other relief workers were expelled?
Well, UNICEF is really totally non-political and humanitarian, and it's proven that over and over again. And even if they were to evacuate the few UNICEF officials that are in that area, you cannot expel UNICEF. UNICEF has been there for 50 years, has helped dig wells, create agricultural centers, given them schools, given them weaving equipment, bought them sheep and cattle and so forth. UNICEF has been working very hard at giving them long-term aid, as we call it. And by that, we don't mean that the aid has to go on forever, but that the results are long-term.
What are UNICEF's current concerns about how the escalation in the war is going to affect their relief efforts?
We're deeply concerned because, as it is, for instance, in the north, the capital of Eritrea is Asmara, which is a city of about 500,000 people. And already in the last few days, about 5,000 refugees have arrived. Asmara is without water. They have no water there. There was the minimum when I was there 2 or 3 weeks ago. People were getting like a quart of water per day for a whole family. I mean, that's just enough to survive on. And there are whole areas where people cannot be reached either by road or by plane, and I just it doesn't bear thinking of what will happen to them.
When you were in Ethiopia, were you able to see the results of the years of relief and famine aid efforts that have been going on?
Oh, yes. That's just what I was telling you about. They have created all over Ethiopia these agricultural communes, these food-for-work projects, as they call it. They feed the people, and in return, they work their land. They have, wherever they could, created a water system, whether it's a well or by capping springs or boring holes. And around this water, there is once again life, because they've been able to plant trees. They've been given seeds to sow, which they didn't have anymore because they ate them in the last famine. They've been given oxen to till their land. They had no cattle anymore because they died in the drought. They've been given sheep and chicken and so forth. And these are highly successful. And these projects have been the only areas where, even this time, they have not needed aid.
Audrey Hepburn is my guest, and she's now a special ambassador for UNICEF, and she recently returned from a trip to Ethiopia. What did you see in Ethiopia that had the biggest effect on you?
The people as a whole, because obviously I was prepared for seeing hunger, seeing the distribution centers. I was expecting to fly on Hercules planes and many things I knew about. What I'd never realized is what an extraordinary people the Ethiopians are. They're very, very beautiful, very proud, have enormous dignity, very patient, very gentle, very hard-working. They're easy to communicate with because they, although I don't know the language, they smile, they touch, but are so extraordinarily silent. It's strange. Also the children. I visited, for instance, a distribution center with a good 2,000 people sitting around in the sand, just waiting for their rations, and there was almost not a murmur. Obviously, children don't run around because they're too weak and don't have the energy that our children would have and be able to be nice and noisy. But the people themselves, too, have such a serenity about them. And I had a long talk with an Ethiopian lady who fortunately spoke English and asked her about this phenomena. She said, I think it has a lot to do with our religion. They're extremely religious. Most of the country, as you may know, is Christian, and Christianity has been in Ethiopia since the 4th century. It actually is the cradle of humanity is in Ethiopia. It's a very old country with a very old culture. And this is what this, I mean, I just gasped constantly at the people and the beauty of the women and their manner.
You're best known as an actress. Did you approach UNICEF or did they approach you to become a special ambassador?
It just happened. I've known UNICEF all my life, as many of us have, and I have off and on been asked to raise funds in some small way or attend a gala or sell Christmas cards. So last year I went to Tokyo for them for a gala UNICEF concert and so forth. And this year, I mean, I had the great privilege of being asked to go on a mission for them, and this has made me extremely happy and a much happier person than I was, because I felt very frustrated at not being able to do anything. I mean, we've all seen the pictures of 85, and we see so much misery around us in our own countries and so forth, and it's a marvelous relief, however little, but to do something.
I know that during the Second World War, you had your mother had sent you to Holland in the hopes that
I was living in Holland. My mother was living there with both my brothers. Yes,
I see, and that was in the hopes of being away from the Nazis. But of course, the Nazis invaded after you moved.
Yes,
there.
Well, Holland had always been neutral, and my mother is Dutch, and I have a whole Dutch family there.
I see,
and that's where we were living. And, you know, we thought it was a good place to be because Holland had always been neutral, but after a very short while we were invaded by the Germans, and the rest is history.
Now, the way I understand it, you had been the recipient of relief after the war.
Right, because especially the last winter was dramatic, in especially where we were living, because our house was between the lines. The British had landed, had their airborne landing in Arnhem. You're too young to know about that, but maybe you've read about it. And that is was one of the bloodiest battles of the war, which failed, and they withdrew to the other side of the river, and we were in the area right there next to Arnhem, with the Germans behind us and the British on the other side of the river, and it became a no-man's land for the civilians. We were not allowed to leave because nobody wanted a lot of refugees taking to the roads, and we had nowhere to go anyway. But no provisions were made. So we really lived from hand to mouth and exchanged whatever we had for a few turnips or whatever it was. And the last winter was really very serious. And as I've just told you now about Ethiopia too, although my case can in no way be compared to the children of Ethiopia, it's the children, the growing children, that show the first signs of malnutrition, which I did have when the war ended. But UNICEF and the Red Cross came in instantly after the liberation with their trucks and filled the local churches and schools with medications and blankets and food. And I was one of the very lucky recipients.
You've never been a very public person, even as an actress. I think you've really avoided a lot of publicity.
How right you are.
I'll tell you the truth. I was almost surprised when I heard that you were a special ambassador for UNICEF, because it meant being in the spokesperson position, mm-hmm. and it's a position you'd avoided for so long.
Yes, but you see, one of the reasons that I never enjoyed doing publicity very much is that I found it very boring to talk about myself over and over again, apart from the fact that I wanted to protect my private life. Whereas now there's something I do want to talk about, and I welcome the opportunity to.
So it's a way of, in a way, using the attention that you would naturally get and using that
right.
for a cause that you believe in.
That's exactly right, yes.
Would you mind terribly if I asked you a few questions about yourself?
No, please.
Are you retired from movies? Do you think of yourself as being retired from films?
I tell you, I withdrew. I've never, because when you say you've retired, that means you'll never ever work again, and you're sort of, you know, retired with a capital R. I've never done that. It's sort of ironic because I started to withdraw from movies when my eldest son started going to school, because I suffered so from being away from him, and I'd wanted to have him so much. That I just decided that was too great a sacrifice, so I stayed home with him, and over the years I've done an occasional picture during the holidays, and then I had a second son, and so that was the same story. So first, I really stayed home on account of my children, and now I'm flying around the world because of children. So it's a switch.
The Academy Awards were your first appearance, public appearance in the film world like that in a long time. Did you have to be talked into it?
No, not at all, but that I've done quite frequently.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
I mean, I presented an award 2 years ago, the awards before last.
Well, you co-presented this year with Gregory Peck, and you co-starred
That's
with
right.
him in your first big film, Roman Holiday.
That's right.
Now, he was already a big star, and you were a newcomer then.
He sure was.
Was it intimidating to work opposite him so early on in your career?
No, it was. I mean, I was so starstruck and so impressed at even meeting this wonderful man, you know. And he turned out to be just the way I thought he would be, a sweet, kind, lovely man, and who gave me an extraordinary example of what it is to be a professional.
William Wyler was the director. Did he cast you for the film?
Yes. He tested many girls, and then I got the part, which was extraordinary. And also thanks to Greg, because he had co-partner approval, or whatever you want to call it.
You know, I'm thinking that when you started making movies in the 50s, that the really fashionable female figure at the time was the full-bodied hourglass figure. you know, very bosomy, big hips. and you are and were such a thin woman, and really set a new kind of style in a way because of your build. But were you self-conscious about being that thin at the time, knowing that it was the buxomy woman that was in?
I grew up full of complexes. I realized what one was supposed to look like, and here I was rather thin, as you say, and flat-chested and lanky and so forth. But apparently William Wyler didn't mind, and so, today I can live with it very happily.
Well, think of how many women would love to be you or look like you. Did you go through a period of trying to gain weight?
No, I've never been able to. The only time I ever sort of put on some weight or got a little bit tubby was right after the war, when the first food started coming in and we'd get care packages with jars of jam and condensed milk, and I'd just eat the whole thing. Eat the whole jam jar and, with a spoon and the condensed milk too, and then obviously be very ill after it. But I put a bit of weight on, and I must have been 10 pounds heavier than I am today.
My guest is actress Audrey Hepburn. She's currently a special ambassador for UNICEF. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Audrey Hepburn is my guest. You had been a ballet dancer when you were young before you took to acting. When you danced with Fred Astaire in Funny Face, did you feel like you learned something from dancing with him?
Oh, that's the understatement of the year, because obviously I couldn't learn from Fred Astaire because I could never learn what he can do. But I had the great thrill of dancing with him and enjoyed the sort of almost the ecstasy of being sort of swept off the floor. He was so light on his feet, and he made you look so much better, and he made you dance better than you could, and it was a divine experience. Fred was a very sweet man, and we had a lot of fun together, and it was one of the better experiences of my life.
I loved your performance in the movie The Nun Story, and I think of that as being a very different kind of role for you. In so many of your movies, you were really like beautifully dressed, and many of your movies were comedies. And in The Nun Story, it's a dramatic film, and you're covered with a habit during most of the movie. Was that a role you were anxious to get?
Oh yes, I was terribly happy to do that. And there again, I worked with a great, great director, Fred Zinnemann. And he's a very thorough man of great integrity. And he put me through months of preparation for that picture.
What kind of preparation?
Oh, he put me in a convent for 2 days
nights
and took me to see one operation after the other in hospitals, and really it was an indoctrination, but I appreciated that. I mean, it was part of a marvelous experience, and also being in Africa for the first time, that was a very different kind of Africa to Ethiopia, the Congo, what was then the Congo and is now Zaire, is a very, very lush, very green, jungle-like country. But that was a very deep, very emotional experience, that picture, especially as I knew and became close friends with Lou Abetz, whom the book was about. She was Sister Luke. And I actually became very close to her because we met before the picture, and I was able to talk to her a little bit about her life, which she was very generous and very free in discussing. But a rather wonderful thing happened was that I was making a, a Western in Mexico for John Huston and broke my back falling off a horse. And I was x-rayed down there and I'd broken four vertebrae and the picture was only halfway through. And I was flown back to Los Angeles to be x-rayed here again and so forth. And the diagnosis was correct. And I was put flat on my back for 5 weeks. But before I ever left Mexico, I got a phone call from Lou, who was then a registered nurse in Los Angeles. She was working as a nurse. And she says, Audrey, I just heard something on the radio. Is it true? I can never believe what I hear. And I said, yes, Lou, I'm flat on my back and I'm coming back tomorrow. And she said, well, I'll come and nurse you. I'll come and take care of you. So when I got home and had to lie flat on my back for 5 weeks, Lou Abetz nursed me, Sister Luke.
That's great.
And we had a lot of laughs. She was a fabulous nurse, but she was such great company.
Did she like the movie?
Did she like the movie? Yes, she was very happy with it, yes.
You were wonderful in Charade opposite Cary Grant. And I think one of the greatest things about acting opposite him is probably his sense of timing when he does his lines.
Oh, brilliant.
It must be great to work
brilliant,
off of someone
yes.
like that.
Oh, sure. I mean, and that's what I was saying before, that it was true also of Rex Harrison and all these marvelous stars that I was lucky enough to play opposite. It's, you know, it's like, I don't know, playing tennis. Even if you're not very good, but if you play with a really good player, it improves your game. And it's hard to miss when you're working with people like that.
How much did you rehearse your lines with Cary Grant? Did you try to do them a lot to get the timing down, or was it more on the spontaneity of it?
You know, timing you can't rehearse. It's an instinct, especially comedy. I mean, that's what made Cary unique. That's why there haven't been a whole lot of Cary Grants. It was part of him. It was his genius, if you like. And you can rehearse a scene, like which door you're going to come in and which chair you're going to sit down on and where you're going to speak and so forth. But you can't rehearse that kind of thing. It has to come from within, like all acting, whether it's comedy or whether it's emotional.
Now, you start in the film version of My Fair Lady. The singing was dubbed by Marnie Nixon.
Right.
Did you know that that was going to happen when you made the film?
Oh, yes. But I mean, nevertheless, I worked very hard on my singing, because actually what they did was, as Marnie Nixon had to sing to her soundtrack, if you like. At the same time, she also had to match me. And we both recorded the songs, me the best I could, and she with her lovely voice. But also, you know, the men in the mixing rooms are so brilliant, because in many cases, in several of the songs, the start of a phrase would be my voice, and they would have just blend into hers. She sang all the difficult parts, and I was able to do a few phrases that were within my reach. And that's why it all matches so well.
Oh, so you really both sung the songs, literally?
Yes, but I mean, I sang a bit of the easier songs. She sang nearly all of the difficult ones. But nevertheless, they started by coming out of my mouth. Do you know what I'm...
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
When you withdrew from movies, did you feel that there was an Audrey Hepburn type that you had established and that there was somebody else who was waiting in the wings to be the next Audrey
oh, no.
Hepburn?
No. I've never been that would be a little complicated, and I think, you know, I'm not that at all about myself. I've just been me all my life, and I've been terribly fortunate to have this career and become an actress just by chance, really. I mean, as we said earlier, I trained as a dancer, and that's what I thought I was going to be. But I don't have an image of myself at all.
But the movie industry had an image of you, though.
It's in the public's eye. It's very hard. I mean, you look at yourself in the mirror, but that's not what other people see, whether it's you or whether it's me, you know. And we're very critical about ourselves. And fortunately, people who like you or love you are not as critical. Otherwise, we'd have no audience.
Just one more thing about movies I wanted to ask you. In several of your films, you've played women who are either very sophisticated or, in one movie, even a princess. Now, you grew up the daughter of a baroness. Did you, what kind of get taught in a way how to be elegant when you were young?
That's a very sweet question. As you say, being the daughter of a baroness doesn't make you any different, except that my mother was born in 1900 and had herself a very strict and, Victorian upbringing, if you like. So she was very demanding of us, of me and my brothers, and manners, as she always said, don't forget, are kindnesses. You must always be kind. Opening the door for an old lady isn't just a routine. It's so that, she's helped. And she was always very adamant about that.
But even your posture and your carriage have always been so perfect.
Well, if that is so, and I'm glad to hear you think so, that has to do with ballet training, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a straight back, and my mother probably had me sleep without a pillow.
Oh, really? Is that supposed to be good for neck posture or something?
Babies shouldn't have pillows, if they have one, very, very flat ones.
Well, speaking of necks, you have such a gorgeous neck. Were you aware of that when you were growing up? Was that something
no,
you were proud of? Or?
I tell you, no. I'm a much happier person about myself today than I was then. I always thought, that I'd never get off the shelf. I didn't think I looked right at all. And today, many movies later, and two sons, and lots of friends, and I may have a few wrinkles, but I'm much happier.
Now that you're working for UNICEF as a special ambassador, are you feeling that somehow the movies that you gave us aren't enough, that you want to do something that is more humanistic, more socially conscious?
No, one has nothing to do with the other. I mean, movies have been my working life. I've always had a life of my own, a private life, and I've always had very deep feelings about my children, about other people's children, about, I dare say, about other people's suffering. And this is just an extraordinary opportunity that's been given me to be allowed to do something finally. One tries to do it near to home, or if you hear of somebody who's in need, or wherever one can. But it's such a relief to me to be able to do something about these children.
For Americans who want to do something, what kind of action would you suggest?
Oh, that would be wonderful. First, let me say that Americans are so generous, and we are all so grateful. But we do need more help now, and if they want to help, please have them call the number which I will give you, which is 1-800-4-KIDS.
That's FORKIDS.
That's right. That every little bit helps, and they really, believe me, need it.
Audrey Hepburn, I thank you very much for the time you spent with us. Thank you very much.
I'm very grateful for this opportunity. Thank you so much.
My guest has been actress Audrey Hepburn, who's now working as a special ambassador for UNICEF, and she recently returned from a trip to Ethiopia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa. His book, The War of the End of the World, won the Ritz-Paris Hemingway Award in 1984. His earlier novel, The Time of the Hero, was publicly burned by the Peruvian military in 1963. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. It took him 12 years, but film director Alan Rudolph has finally made the movie of his dreams. It's called The Moderns, it's set in the Paris art scene of the 20s, and it stars Keith Carradine, John Lone, and Genevieve Bugeaud. Coming up, Rudolph tells us about filming one of the most rejected scripts in history. Also, pianist and singer Mac Rebennack, better known as Dr. John, pays tribute to a fellow New Orleans pianist, Cousin Joe. And ABC has a new daytime show called Home. Our critic-at-large Laurie Stone has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Four U.S. Navy minesweepers today found and destroyed two more mines in the same area of the Persian Gulf where the U.S. frigate Samuel Roberts struck a mine yesterday. U.S. officials have determined the devices were planted recently, indicating an escalation in the Gulf War. NPR's Anne Garrels has this report.
Administration officials believe Iran has resumed laying mines. According to officials, the appearance of new mines represents a dangerous change in Iranian tactics, a willingness to confront the United States in the Persian Gulf. Officials say it's safe to assume the U.S. will retaliate. The USS Samuel Roberts is one of 29 American warships stationed in the Persian Gulf. And speaking to the American Society of Newspaper Editors today, Vice President Bush defended President Reagan's decision to escort reflagged Kuwaiti oil tankers through the Gulf. "We must not be driven out," Bush said, adding, U.S. credibility in the area is at stake. Towed by a tug, the USS Samuel Roberts is limping toward Dubai, where it's expected to undergo repairs. Four of the 10 injured crewmen have been evacuated to Bahrain for burn treatment. Three are seriously injured, but officials say their lives are not in danger. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Vice President George Bush said today that Libya is propping up the regime of Panamanian military leader Manuel Noriega. Bush said several reliable sources indicate that Noriega is receiving millions of dollars in support from Libya. Appearing before the American Society of Newspaper Editors, Bush denied that he knew Noriega was personally involved in drug trafficking until the Panamanian general was indicted by a federal grand jury. The United States today vetoed a UN Security Council resolution urging Israel to halt deportations of Palestinians from the occupied territories. The Palestine Liberation Organization representative at the United Nations condemned the veto, saying it shields Israel from international criticism. In Israel today, dozens of Israeli settlers, guarded by dozens of Israeli army troops, marched to reenact the hiking trip last week that ended with the deaths of a 15-year-old Israeli girl and two Palestinians. In another West Bank town, soldiers clashed with Palestinian families who had come to see relatives held in a military detention center. At least four people were wounded there. In South Africa, one person has been killed and one injured in two bomb blasts in the capital, Pretoria. The bombs went off simultaneously this evening. Nigel Wrench reports.
One bomb exploded on the steps of a crowded cinema complex. Police said this was where the casualties were. They cordoned off the area as ambulances ferried the dead and injured away. The cinemas are the biggest in Pretoria. At the same time, a second bomb went off outside a discount store in the center of the city. Damage was extensive, but it appeared there were no injuries. No groups claimed responsibility for either blast. There have been three other explosions in the Johannesburg-Pretoria area this week. Just last night, a bomb exploded on the steps of Johannesburg City Hall. There were no injuries, but the blast caused extensive damage to the building. It may be the beginning of a renewed campaign of bombing by the banned African National Congress. This could be the ANC's answer to the crackdown on anti-apartheid organizations. For National Public Radio, this is Nigel Wrench in Johannesburg.
Former White House spokesman Larry Speaks has resigned as chief spokesman for Merrill Lynch. The resignation comes just days after Speaks admitted he once made up quotes for President Reagan. Speaks said in a statement today that resigning is the best course of action for Merrill Lynch and himself. The brokerage firm denied that Speaks was asked to resign, but says the resignation is due to the publication of his book, in which Speaks admitted that he had fabricated quotes and attributed them to the president. Current presidential spokesman Marlon Fitzwater called the practice a damn outrage. Fitzwater said today he's sorry for Speaks personally, but he had no other comment. And on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones average closed at 2013.93. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Over the past few weeks, we've been hearing from our performer-in-residence, Mac Rebenack, who's also known as Dr. John. He's been sharing the various musical styles of his native New Orleans with us. Today, it's the blues.
Now I'd like to do a couple of tunes that I learned from Mr. Google Eyes and Cousin Joseph Pleasance, a couple of the great blues singers of New Orleans that's still around today. And some of my favorite old blues by Cousin Joe thing here called Life is a One-Way Ticket. You know, life is a one-way ticket. There ain't no second time around. Life is a one-way ticket. There ain't no second time around. Better get all you can out of life before you 6 feet in the ground. When you get your big money, you better buy everything you could. When you get your big money, better buy everything you could. You know you can't take it with you. Lord, when you're dead, all the money in the world won't do you no good. Some people believe in reincarnation. I believe when you're dead, you're done. Incarnation. I believe when you're dead, you're done. I've been from here to eternity, trying to find my place in the sun. So when you get your big money, you better buy everything you could. Get your big money, better buy everything you can get. You know you can't take it with you. I ain't never seen an armored car at a funeral yet. That's one of my favorites by Cousin Joe, and here's another one that he did back in the bebop era with cats like Charlie Parker and Diz. In fact, this is the one blues song you ever hear Dizzy Gillespie sing. It's called Ain't, Baby You Ain't So Such a Much. Wouldn't give a blind pig an acorn, wouldn't give a crippled crab a crutch. Wouldn't give a blind pig an acorn, wouldn't give a crippled crab a crutch. Baby, you and your loving, you ain't so such a much. You know I'm only 38, my woman's 93. You know my friends all think I'm crazy, but the will's made out to me. Old women, old women know just what to do. They give you all kind of good old loving, some good old money too. Thank you. thick and slim. You know they ain't giving you no money, baby, for what you giving them. You know it wouldn't give a blind pig an acorn, wouldn't give a crippled crab a crutch. Now, baby, you and your loving, you know you ain't so such a mud. Cousin Joseph Pleasant's music, and I'll leave you with a little taste of one of his old little boogie grooves, something like this here.
We'll hear more from Mac Rabinac in the next few weeks. A collection of his music has just been released on compact disc. It's called The Ultimate Dr. John. This is Fresh Air. The Paris art scene of the 1920s is the setting for Alan Rudolph's new offbeat film, The Moderns. Rudolph's other movies include Made in Heaven, Trouble in Mind, Choose Me, Remember My Name, and Welcome to L.A. But he says The Moderns is the film closest to his heart. He tried to make the film for 12 years, despite countless rejections. In The Moderns, Rudolph has reunited actors that have become part of his ensemble cast. Keith Carradine stars as a struggling American expatriate artist. Genevieve Bugeaud is the owner of a Paris art gallery. And Geraldine Chaplin plays a wealthy art collector. The film also features Wallace Shawn, John Lone, and Linda Fiorentino. I asked Alan Rudolph why he wanted to make a film about Paris in the 20s.
I think that was the mecca, and certainly in this century, of creative accomplishment. Actually, not accomplishment. It was just it was a great melting pot of ideas and artists and crackpots, and it seemed to be the one glorious time in this century. They called it the Great Good Place.
The artists and gallery owners and collectors in your movie all have a touch of the con artist in them, and I think that's true of a lot of the characters in your movies. I get the feeling that you really love that in the characters that you create, that sense of the con.
Well, I don't know if it's a con as much as truth seems to be negotiable these days, and certainly back then. But you defined it. I mean, the artists, the critics, the gallery owners, I mean, these people are all on the hustle. They still are now. And I think that's what was happening in Paris 1926, is really they carved out the rules for the future self-promotion. That was the collision of modern art and modern money.
Dear boy, the first principle of artistic survival is to parlay talent into cash. Have you heard of, do you know Madame Nathalie Deville?
No.
Special woman, very beautiful, very vulnerable, very wealthy. Her husband's just ran off with dancers at Bash, and now, of course, she wants to go to America without him. She still has her pride. Why?
I'm not in the travel business, Libby.
She has three wonderful paintings she would rather like to take with her.
So?
Well, if she takes the originals with her, there should be copies left behind. The husband must never know. It's a very delicate situation requiring the utmost discretion. Quite naturally, she confided in me.
It's forgery.
Forgery? Forgery is criminal. These are copies.
Now, I think you wrote the first draft of The Moderns 12 years ago, and you've called it the most rejected script in Hollywood history.
Well, and that's just not a self-deprecating statement. It's actually quite, I don't know if they keep records of these things, but we have over 100 official rejections. I wrote it for about 6 years on my own. I kept rewriting it every year because it was a way to revisit the situation. It was always to be my next film. And about 1979 or 80, John Bradshaw, who was a dear friend and a real good writer, a journalist, said, "You need me to get this film made." He said, "I'll bring structure to it. You keep writing these dream things, and you need some reality." So we collaborated, and again, we wrote it to every chance we get. I think every phone call we ever made to each other, which is at least 5 a week, was always about The Moderns. And I think ultimately we never thought we'd make the film. We just wanted to go to the Lacopole and get drunk. But he died. He pulled the ultimate joke on us and died right around Thanksgiving, 86. And so we just decided that we had to make the film for him no matter what. We could never raise the money. Bradshaw and I, we used to submit it to these studios knowing they wouldn't like it, but hoping they would. And they would, of course, reject it. Then we'd wait for the studio heads to change, which was inevitable, almost seasonal. And then we'd resubmit it, and they'd reject it again.
Well, why do you think it was the most rejected script? What were the reasons you were given when studios turned it down?
It's too good. It didn't have the hook. You had to think about it, you know. And I don't know, anytime you mention artists or art in a film...
God, let alone puns about Marcel Duchamp. I mean, I guess that won't help.
Hollywood just is, you know, I mean... sort of monolithic lunacy. They're chasing their own tail, and they're on a roll now. Everything is successful, but it's all pretty much the same movie being made over and over again.
When your partner, John Bradshaw, died in 1986, it made you want to make the film even more, in a way, as a tribute to him. But what were you able to do to actually get it off the ground?
Well, we... You conceive of a film in Paris, about Paris in the 20s, and Paris is more than just a geographical location. It's really a state of mind and a place of exhilarating atmosphere. So we never considered that it could even be shot anywhere else. But when Bradshaw died, I knew we had to make it. For reasons that you can never explain to anybody, and so we did it in Montreal for whatever money that Carolyn Pfeiffer, who co-produced it with David Blocker and who is the president of Alive Films, whatever she could raise, we made it for, and she raised $3.5 million. So we did it in Montreal, and actually I think the film maybe turned out better than if we had shot it in Paris, because we were forced to get more clever, and I think it was never intended to be a travelogue of Paris. It was really a Paris of the mind.
Is there an example of how you think there was something more clever in it as a result of it being in Montreal?
Well, because we, of course, didn't have the Eiffel Tower, and we didn't have the river, and we didn't have all the architecture, but we wanted to include that. It became more of a dream film, and an approximation of the mood. And so you see the Eiffel Tower all over the place, but you see it in rather curious incarnations. And somehow,
sure, like souvenirs, ashtrays, lamps, things like that.
Well, people are always painting it, and then actually it appears in two scenes as backdrop for two sequences, but it's rather cubist. I mean, you look out the window, and there's a cubist Eiffel Tower out there. But it becomes... somewhat symbolic, which is kind of interesting in a film that is about an era of symbols.
There's an incredible sense of spontaneity that you get from the actors in the film, but on the other hand, every shot looks so well composed and organized and rhythmically thought out beforehand. It strikes me as an incredible balance, one that's really difficult to achieve.
Well, that's actually my code, is that I like to give the actors a lot of freedom and yet have a fairly well-designed a photographic pattern, although I never know what we're doing until we're actually shooting it. But actually, it's quite interesting, that combination of spontaneity and control, because the actors become free and not restricted by the camera, but once we've worked out a certain staging, they have no idea what the camera is doing and are allowed to really behave as opposed to perform.
Well, this is a film that you've worked on for about a decade, more than that. And now it's done, and it's going to be reviewed, and it's going to be seen by audiences. Are you nervous about that, or are you doing anything differently for the opening of this movie than you've done for your other films, since it's so special to you?
No, I'm drinking more. Actually, I'm used to showing films and ducking, you know. I mean, it seems to be from the beginning my films have met with equal parts support and derision, but I feel so good about this film that I almost don't care what anybody thinks. I mean, I feel that we accomplished what we tried to do. I feel Bradshaw would be pleased, although he and I would still be arguing over certain things. And but as far as me personally showing this film, I'm just proud to show it. I just hope people respond to it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Alan Rudolph's new film, The Moderns, just opened in New York. It will open across the country in the coming weeks. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we're following developments in the Persian Gulf. U.S. minesweepers did today find some more, it seems, newly laid mines. They may have been put there by Iran. As you know, yesterday a U.S. frigate was struck by a mine and damaged. Also, following the presidential primary campaign, it's really only a Democratic campaign now in New York State, we'll have this evening what we hope to be the first of three extended talks with the Democratic presidential hopefuls. This evening, Albert Gore, the Tennessee Democratic senator, and a report on trying to teach children about child abuse in order to prevent it. Is it worth it to teach them that much to make them the wiser?
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a new daytime TV magazine called Home. Critic at large Laurie Stone says this ABC program portrays a home life that is more appropriate to the 1950s than the 1980s.
Sandy Hill and Rob Weller, the hosts of ABC's new half-hour show, Home, chant the title of their program like a mantra. Home, home. They lay out welcome homes and command you to stay home and beg you to come home. There's nasty stuff out there. AIDS, heavy metal, marauding bands of single women wielding meat cleavers. ABC claims to have spent more money developing this show than any in the network's history. For a year, researchers asked women what they wanted, and in response, this gingham-shrouded test tube entity was delivered. The show is aimed exclusively at women. Ward is working. Women who save scraps of wallpaper and crochet covers for toilets and leave notes in Ward's pockets to keep the romance alive. Experts come on and show you how to turn old onion bags into pot scrapers. Household hints alternate with inspirational segments. A blind woman who adopted six handicapped children. A group of women who sew quilts for terminally ill kids. These people come off decent and kind, but that's not enough. They're supposed to represent heroism amid domesticity, supposed to make quotidian reality not just bearable, but ennobling. Home looks like a Smithsonian exhibit of 50s kitsch. The world is married, hetero, housebound, and white. I haven't seen a single ethnic guest. Girls are feminine, and the world, being the home, is also feminine. We don't talk about out there. Out there is the male domain, and we don't really want to mingle much with men. We want appreciation, not orgasms, certainly not on those clean sheets. Men are the reason for home, but only in an abstract way. In the flesh, they're best used for opening jars and ordering meals at restaurants. In one segment, a woman's dream date was staged, which included the man not only pre-ordering food and drinks for her, but fastening her seatbelt. The show's only redeeming quality is that it keeps deconstructing as guests shore up dignity against the waves of patronization and blast off from the retro time warp. Sandy dives into hyper-commiserating tabloid mode, but a young woman with dyslexia refuses to overstate her suffering. Sandy interrupts a craftswoman's demonstration with nagging, obvious questions, and the guest finally snaps, "I'm getting to that." Our hosts, hard-as-nails career dame Sandy, and Rob, who also hosts Entertainment Tonight, are hilariously detached from home's trumped-up blue-collar context. Sandy squeals she can't wait to try those $1.98 curtains in her bedroom, and Rob leaks a look that says, "Sure, and I'm Queen Marie of Romania." When Sandy makes Rob eat a homemade pickle concoction, he begrudgingly tastes a tiny bit, then confesses it's awful. Sandy gives us a "men the weenies" look. Rob appears horribly uncomfortable all the time, and for good reason. Since the show relentlessly insists that housekeeping is women's work, he's relegated to eunuch in the sorority house. These last few weeks, he's had a wicked case of flu. My hope is he flies the chicken coop before home comes crashing down around him.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time I'll speak with jazz singer Chris Connor. She first became known for her performances with Stan Kenton's band. She has a new album. Also, jazz critic Evan Whitehead will review She's a Great, Great Girl, the second album by vocalist Daryl Sherman. And television critic David Bianculli will discuss how the writer's strike has revived, at least for now, the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to hear from you. Write us if you have a few minutes. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.